back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yada. I am just tremendously encouraged. I don't think there's ever been a time where Americans in particular, and I have every reason to assume this is also true down under in Australia and New Zealand, as well as throughout many of the European countries, never been a time when so many people were willing to break free of the societal mindset. You know, in Europe and New Zealand, Australia, the United States, and many South American countries, there has been this mindset that the government, when it commits a nation to war, is right and you all need to rally around the flag. And for the first time, we now have leaders of nations. It occurred in Britain. The majority of the politicians wanted to engage in war again. People said, no, we don't want you to do that. Look at the mess you created the last time. United States, the same thing. Two-thirds of the people say, no. I don't care what you say. We don't believe you. You know, you lied to us when you told us what happened in Benghazi. The former administration, the other side of the political aisle, lied to us when it justified its invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq. And look at the mess we made. No, we're not going to rally around the flag this time. We're not going to be misled into war as we were with the Lusitania in World War I. We're not going to be lured into war as we were at the Gulf of Tonkin incident in Vietnam. We're not going to be lured into war based upon weapons of mass destruction which were non-existent. We're not going to believe you. And we're not going to fight a perpetual state of war. No. We're opposed to it. I've never seen a time, certainly in the history of America, Americans have almost always been lemmings as it relates to the patriotic call to arms. This is the first time that has not occurred. Even the majority of Americans rallied around the president when we lied to them and sacrificed lives for nothing in Vietnam. And yet, now, the majority of Americans know we ought not begin another war. That means that people are beginning to question politics, patriotism. Now, I don't know how thin this is, but it's an opportunity. And where an opportunity exists to get people to question the things that they have been indoctrinated to believe, there is hope. And that is because the lone hope of our salvation is to be open to what God had to say. And God approaches us using evidence and reason. And those things are considered anathema. They are wholly opposed by those who are primarily political or religious. They will never consider evidence and reason. But when you begin to question, then, and only then, can what God has to tell us resonate. A friend of mine this morning sent me an email that I wanted to share with you. It has the new Pope of the Roman Catholic Church. And this man is dangerous. I oppose the Roman Catholic Church with every fiber of my body, so I'm not trying to root for Roman Catholics to replace him. But I'm telling you, this is not the sharpest tool in the shed. He was responding to a list of questions published in the paper by a Mr. Scalfari, who is not a Roman Catholic, and Francis wrote to him, "You ask me if the God of Christians..." Now, that should have been the ultimate red flag. If you're a Roman Catholic, if you're a Christian, and you hear those words, the God of the Christians, that's like the God of the Muslims, that's like the gods of the Hindus. When you hear the God of in that context, you need to recognize this is a God that has been created by that religion.
There's more than one God. That's what you have to assume from that.
You absolutely do. And so the God that was conceived by Christianity, which is based upon the sun god religions of Babylon, that is the God that he's now answering on behalf of. He didn't say, "You ask me if Yahweh, He didn't say, if you ask me about the God who says his one and only name is Yahweh, and that he is the God who established the covenant with Abraham, Yitzhak, and Jacob, you're not asking, I'm not responding to you and telling you that the God who authored the Torah. He said that if you ask me if the God of the Christians forgives. Now, what again? What's the problem with religion? Religion is focused on promising people forgiveness and therefore salvation. God would be insane if that was his priority. If that was the thing that God was most concerned about, then God would be insane. If he wanted, if your God is motivated to save everyone, then heaven can be no different than earth. And all of the hell that we perpetrate on ourselves here would be perpetrated on ourselves there, except there it would last an eternity. That is insane. It's unreasonable. If you think that's the case, that God wants to and will save everyone, then I'm telling you, your God is not God. Your God is insane. If the Christian God forgives, now, I'm going to go one step further. Yahweh makes it really clear that the process to salvation is that salvation is the third step along the way. It's not the first. It's not the priority. It's not offered to everyone. The first step along the way is getting to know God as he is, as he introduced himself to us. His name is Yahweh. You can get to know him by reading his Torah, his teaching. So that's the first step. The second step is once you get to know him, if you like him, if you respect him based upon who he actually is and what he has done, the second step is to listen to what he has to say about forming a relationship with him, the covenant. Think about it. Come to understand it. And then respond to it. And so that's the second step along the way, is engage in a relationship with Yahweh based upon the formula that he provided, which is the covenant. Salvation, forgiveness, therefore, is the byproduct of that. God saves his children. Eternity is for God's children. That's why eternity will be so radically different than life here on earth, which is so mucked up by so many political and religious institutions. Salvation is a byproduct of being adopted into God's family. Our Heavenly Father does this for us. So this Pope has already made two points wrong, got two statements wrong. You asked me about the God of the Christians and forgives. Those who don't believe, does God ever tell us to believe him? Never once. God points out that he gave us on the Salma an access to knowledge so that we would have the opportunity to use our ability to think rationally, to discern between that which is good for us and that which is not, that which is truthful and that which is not. And so you do not come to know God through faith. In fact, once you come to know him, faith becomes superfluous. The God of the Torah is eminently knowable. There's no reason to believe him. You can know him. You know, there's a lot of atheists that say that, you know, there's no proof that God exists, therefore why believe there is a God? Well, there is absolute proof that God exists. Absolute, undeniable proof that God exists. But to understand that, you have to be able to think rationally. You have to be able to exercise good judgment, and you have to be willing to investigate the evidence. There is one way that God could and did prove that he exists, prove precisely who he is, and also prove, demonstrate conclusively that he wrote the Torah, prophets, and Psalms to us. There's one way for him to do that without interfering with free will, and he did that very thing. Because he is eternal, because like the language he chose to reveal himself to us in Hebrew, he is not stuck in time. He can witness our future in our past. And as a result, he doesn't predict the future, but he's capable of reporting future history to us, which is why 100% of the prophecies that he has provided, thousands of precise predictions of exactly what was going to occur, aren't actually predictions. They're future history reported in our past. And when you begin to evaluate all of the statements that he made about what was going to happen and put them in writing, sometimes centuries, millennia before they occurred, and you witness their precise fulfillment exactly as he told us was going to happen, there becomes just a matter of doing the math. It becomes just in 25 of the more interesting predictions regarding Yahusha, the corporeal manifestation of Yahweh. If you just take the chance fulfillment of those, you get to 10 to the 56th or 57th power, which is more than there are fundamental elements in the entire universe. You know, it's trillions to 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 one of the chance fulfillment. God proved beyond any doubt that he exists, that he is who he says he is, and that he authored the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. If you invest the time, if you are rational, you can know for certain there's no reason for faith. There's no reason for belief. The evidence is all there. Now, I'm going to tell you, I wrote Yada Yah to reveal that evidence to you so you could see the precision of his creation account. You could see the precision of his story of the flood. You could see his precision of the encounters that took place in Eden. You could see the precision of the story of Abraham and the formation of the covenant. And all the prophecies that he made regarding his story to us and the unfolding nature of human history. Always on his schedule. But it came to mind for me, and for many of you who have read these books, that in an introtogod.org, introtogod.org, it's yadayah.com, introtogod.org, what you find is there's a more powerful way beyond all of this to know that God exists and to know him. And that's the beauty of the writing, the quality of the writing, the depth of the message, the profound nature of the message, the just marvelous nature of the author of this message. When you get to know what he said, you fall in love with him. He's irresistible. I'm Yada. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're criticizing something that the current Pope Francis had to say during the commercial break. Scott was saying is the best Catholic Pope of all time. And we were laughing because can you imagine Yahweh at his trial? You know, thus far, every Catholic Pope has gone directly to Sheol, to the abyss, to be incarcerated along with HaSatan. And finally gets to Francis and says, I don't know what to do with you. I mean, you are so stupid. It's hard to hold you accountable for what you said and did because you're none of your oars are touching the water, pal. But he'd also have to say that, you know, based upon what you said, more people left the Roman Catholic Church than ever before, and that's a really good thing. So it should be rewarding you for being so stupid as opposed to condemning you for being so stupid. Well, anyway, here's what he wrote. Francis wrote, "You ask me if the God of the Christians," and we've spoken about why that's wrong. There is one God. His name is Yahweh, and he is the God of the covenant. If he is going to identify himself with anything, he will identify himself and call himself the God of Abraham, Yitzhak, and Jacob. And the reason is those are the three individuals with whom he formed and reaffirmed his covenant. Forgives. Wrong order. God only forgives his children. No one else. This is not about first coming to know him, second about coming to understand the relational offer he is making to us, and then as a byproduct of that being forgiven. Then he goes to who don't believe and who do not seek the faith. We've talked about belief. Belief is for those who do not know. And in the last segment, I shared with you how easy it is to know. Now, easy in the sense of it doesn't take a great mind, but it does take a great deal of time. Unless you're willing to prioritize knowing Yahweh and coming to be able to know for certain that he exists, you won't find him. So it does take a lot of time and a willingness to approach him with an open mind. That's why I'm so positive about the times that we're living, because people are beginning to think independently for the first time in a very long time. Then he says, and who do not seek the faith. As I rewrite Questioning Paul, a book I wrote for some odd years ago, and I have basically doubled its length, significantly improving it based upon what I've learned. And as I write it now, one of the things that I've come to understand is that Paul was speaking of the faith. It just wasn't just faith in him, because what Paul basically said is you can ignore the Torah. You ought to ignore the Torah. The Torah enslaves. The Torah was mean. The Torah can't save. The Torah is impotent. The Torah is this horrible pornographic document that you ought to at all costs reject. And everything that's written in the Torah, you need to reject if you're going to benefit from the faith. That Paul was establishing the faith known as Christianity, and that Christianity and the faith became indistinguishable. And that is precisely what this Pope is referencing here. Seek the faith. It's not about seeking to know Yahweh. It's not about seeking to know the covenant and understand it and respond to it. It's seeking the faith. The faith is the religion of Christianity as it was composed by Paul. May I interrupt our presentation here to remind you, since we were talking about Thomas Jefferson during our first hour, one of the things that's most interesting about Thomas Jefferson is he wrote that Paul was the first to corrupt the message of Yahusha. He knew what took me a long time to find out, that everything that Paul wrote was designed expressly to corrupt and to convolute the message of Yahusha, and therefore the message of Yahweh, and therefore the Torah. There's a reason that his reference, when he studied the life of Yahusha, was comprised of Yahusha's words only. He removed everything else. Something to think about if you're still a patriot, Americans. So he says, if you ask me about the God of the Christians, whether he forgives those who don't believe and who don't seek the faith, I start by saying, this reminds me of everything that Paul wrote. Paul would say, but I, Paulos, say, I myself, Paul, say. Ladies and gentlemen, if your answer to a question regarding God begins with, but I say, then you have no hope of being right. None. The answer to every question about God, about a relationship with him, about who he is, about knowing what he's going to do, always begins with, Yahweh says. In the Torah he wrote. In the prophets he proclaimed. When you begin, but I say, it's over. You're wrong. So we're responding to the idiocy of the current Roman Catholic Pope Francis. He said in writing to a publication, you ask me if the God of the Christians forgives those who don't believe and who don't seek the faith. I start by saying. This is, again, just like all of Paul's letters. I, Paul, say. And if you begin there, you have no hope of being right. There's a reason that I do this show under an anonymous name. It's Yada, a Hebrew word that means to know, and to know in a relational sense. There's a reason I tell you that I'm flawed and that I possess no credentials that would impress anyone, because I'm irrelevant. If you read yadayah.com, if you read Introduction to God, the first statement in both of those books is, I'm irrelevant. This is not about me. What you'll find is the only thing that is relevant is who Yahweh is and what he shared with us. He has the answers. If you want to know the answers, observe what he wrote. Listen to what he said. When you begin saying, I start by saying, you're cooked. Now it's your views and as if your opinions matter. Our opinions don't matter. They don't. They're irrelevant to God. God does not care about our opinions. When it comes to who he is, what he said is what counts. When it comes to how to engage in a relationship with him, the nature of that covenant, which is a mutually beneficial, mutually binding agreement. God has five promises. He expects five things from us. If you don't want to play, you want to change the rules, sayonara. Goodbye. So you cannot have any hope of being right if you start with, I start by saying. But that's the problem with Roman Catholicism. That's the church has decided that they can trump God. It's what happened with the Judaism. It's why rabbinical Judaism is such a heinous religion. The rabbinical arguments are against God. The Talmud states that rabbis have authority over God and over the people. Then he says, and this is the fundamental thing. Now, the fundamental thing is the Torah. That's the only fundamental thing. And the fundamental aspect of the Torah is the covenant. And so if he had begun and say, the fundamental thing is the Torah, it's the foundation. And the centerpiece of the Torah is the covenant. And this is what? Yahweh. The one who conceived the covenant and established it with Abraham and Yitzhak and Jacob after him. This is what he has to say on that question. Well, then you'd be absolutely right. But he says this is the fundamentalist thing and doesn't mention any of the fundamentals. That God's mercy, and it's God, not Yahweh, because he doesn't know Yahweh. It's the Christian God, obviously, that he's speaking of. That God's mercy has no limits. Now, his mercy has no limits as it relates to his children. But it is absolutely limited to his children. If he did not limit it to his children, then he would be unmerciful. One of the things that the political correctness does not want you to appreciate is that it is absolutely merciful to be intolerant of those things which are unmerciful. God has to be intolerant of religion. He has to draw the line and say, if you're religious, you're not coming into my home. I'm not going to spend my eternity with you. If you're political, you're not coming into my home. I will not spend my eternity with you. I'm not going to share my home with you. If you're militaristic, you're not coming into my home. God has to draw the line. He has to be opposed to those things which are opposed to his family, to his plan. And he is. This notion that God's mercy has no limits is insane. It has to. And it does. God's mercy is limited to his covenant children. And to be a member of the covenant, you have to distance yourself from religion and politics, from your country. If you're not willing to do so, then you cannot have a relationship with God. And so his mercy is only for his children, wholly unlimited for them, but wholly constrained for anyone other than his children. So this says that God's mercy has no limits if you go to him with a sincere and contrite heart, all about feelings. Now, Yahweh does speak a lot about the heart. He wants his Torah. He wants us initially to place his Torah on our hearts. And then later he says that when he renews his covenant and upon his return, that he's going to write his Torah on our hearts. And when it's brought into your heart, you have to bring it into your heart through your eyes and your ears so that you read it and then listen to what he has to say. And then that's processed through your mind and understood through the benefit of your Nesama. So that this information is processed so that it is understood, and then once you understand it and react and engage and embrace it, that act of embracing it, of acting upon it, brings it into your core. Then it becomes part of you. But if you start with the heart, then you're just led away by faith and infatuation, by your feelings, which will almost always betray an individual. Because feelings are so much part of our societal indoctrination. So a sincere and contrite heart. So from this Pope's point of view, it's not God's teaching, not his guidance that matters. It's not what God says that matters. What matters is the nature of a person's heart. So God's mercy is he has absolutely no ability, which this Pope is saying, God has absolutely no ability to apply his mercy consistent with his own teaching, his own guidance and directions. He can't apply his mercy based upon his plan and who he is. God's mercy has to be applied, according to this Pope, based upon each individual's heart and whether their heart is sincere or contrite. Under that basis, why write the Torah? Why write the prophets? Why have Yohanan and Matanyah, the disciples, chronicle the words of Yahusha? Why did Yahusha bother with the pain of Pesach, Passover, as the Passover lamb? Why did he bother with the pain of separation in matzah? What is the purpose of Bukurim, the firstborn children? Why Shabuah? Why having the promise of seven enriching and empowering us? Why have any of this? Why have the children of Yisrael? Why have them freed from enslavement in the crucible of Egypt? Why? What's the purpose of Yahweh talking with Abraham and drawing him away from Babylon so that he could have a relationship with it? What's the purpose of any of it if none of that matters? If the only thing that matters is whether or not a person has a sincere and contrite heart, what's the purpose of any of it? What is the purpose? Why did Yahusha sacrifice so much? Then he goes on to say, the issue for those who do not believe in God is to obey their conscience. Do you know that there isn't a Hebrew word for obey? So I can tell you for certain that obeying is not the means to salvation, because in the whole of the Torah, in the prophets and the Psalms, as Yahweh articulates who he is, the means to form a relationship with him, and the benefits of that relationship which lead to our salvation, never once does he tell us to obey him. Never once. Never once speaks of obedience. So I can tell you for certain that this Pope is wrong. He doesn't even ask us to obey him, much less our conscience. Our conscience is from a concept that this Pope knows nothing of. It's from Nesalma. It is the thing that makes humankind different than all other animals. All other animals, like Homo sapiens, have a soul. Consciousness, the ability to observe and respond to our environment, the things that we see, the things that we hear. And beyond that, humankind was given a conscience, a nesalma, for the express purpose of being able to exercise good judgment regarding that which is truthful and that which is not, that which is of God and that which leads away from him. And so we aren't asked to obey our conscience. We're asked to use our conscience. It's a tool. It's not an authoritarian lord that dictates to us. No. It's a tool, no different than a shovel. Or for someone like me whose eyes are no longer as focused as they once were, like glasses. You know, I use store-bought magnifiers. It's a tool that I use so that I can see words more clearly. Our nesalma is a tool. You don't obey a tool. That's like saying to these glasses, I'm going to obey you. I'm going to be obedient to the glasses. No, I use them. The nesalma is a tool, a gift from God for us to use. It can lead us to a relationship with God because it can lead us to coming to know him, coming to respect him, coming to love him, coming to understand his covenant offer, how to participate in it. And for those of us who incorporate those teachings into our lives and who respond to them, God's mercy is unlimited. He saves us. Flawed people become perfect in his eyes, his children, as he watches us grow. This Pope got everything wrong. He then said sin, even for those who have no faith, exists when people disobey their conscience. Guy is absolutely clueless. Sin, according to Yahweh, is primarily promoted by religion. Yahusha made this point unbelievably clear. It's too bad Christians don't listen to him. He was talking about the yeast that is being removed by unyeasted bread, matzah, the most important day each year on the calendar. And he speaks of that yeast that is being removed. He says that's the stuff of the scribes and the Pharisees, the political and religious leaders. It's politics and religion that is the source of sin. And there's no greater source of sin in our world today than the Roman Catholic Church. It is sin is for those who have faith. Miss in a moment. Welcome back to the last segment of Shattering Myths for today. As we press deeper into the story of Eden, we discover that Yahweh's testimony is focused upon developing a relationship with his creation, and a relationship with his creation that also models the covenant relationship he wishes to establish with us. This loving association is set into the context of marriage, of family, of men and women coming together as husband and wife, and then as mother and father, all to raise children, to conceive life, and to nurture children and help them grow. It is God conceived, therefore, Adam to be more than just a companion for him, but for Adam and Chawa, as we shall soon see, to model the covenant so that we would come to know who God is as our Heavenly Father, who God is when he reaches out to us in his maternal aspect of his nature as the set-apart spirit, all for the purpose of enlarging and caring for his covenant family, his children. So this next statement is marvelous. Yahweh, Almighty, said, "It is not good, it is not beneficial, Tob, for the man Adam to exist alone. I will make for him a helper, a supporter, an Ezar, one who assists and renews, aids and provides benefit. Like in the same manner as his corresponding counterpart, Neged." That's Bar-Reshith 2:18. Brilliant. The opening sentence of the passage delineates the consequence of choosing to be separated from God. That's not good. Yahweh Almighty said that it is not good for man to exist separated. That's not good. What's good is to be engaged in a relationship with Yahweh. That's what's good. And so God explains how we do that by what he does next. He establishes humankind such that men and women come together as husband and wife in a marriage vow to become mother and father and to conceive a family in a protective home where we nurture and teach and raise, protect our children. So he transitions from saying it is not good for man to be alone to explaining the means that through his covenant that he has presented and prepared for us to be with him. The living manifestation of his covenant is what follows his statement, it's not good for you to be alone. It's not good for you to be estranged. It's not good for you to be separated. Therefore, God manifests in our very nature a metaphor that is symbolic in every possible way with the covenant, with coming to know him as he is his heavenly father, with coming to know the covenant as his family, coming to know his home as a sheltered place conducive to children, helping us grow, become more than we are. It was brilliant. You know, it's in the second sentence, Yahweh speaks of the epitome of love as we know it. You know, boys for girls, men for women, women for men, husbands for wives, wives for their husbands. And in the process, the ultimate love, which is that of for our children. He speaks of the one that he's going to give to Adam as a counterpart, as one who renews and who assists this woman. Now, it's not presenting woman as in servitude. No, co-worker. Someone right alongside. There's so much stuff that can be done. And work is not a bad thing. It's a good thing. I mean, all the work that we do to raise our children is rewarded 100-fold. And that's what he's saying. There's stuff to do. There's work to be enjoyed. Things to engage in. Love is a wonderful thing. It's an active thing, however. And that's what he's saying here. It's active. It's Izar. We can help one another. We can support one another. We can serve one another. We can aid and renew and benefit one another. When we engage, that's the nature of relationships, just as it is with the covenant. You don't become a member of God's family by simply believing. You have to engage, just as we have to engage to celebrate love. This is a statement that we'll return to at the first hour of our program tomorrow, because it is a brilliant insight into the nature of the covenant and into Yahweh. May Yah bless.